Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Sunday, October 25th, 2015. Time is 3 p.m. Members present are Representative Wilson, Guerra, Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler, Co-Chair Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Newman, Representative Guttenberg, Gaddis, Edgman, and Munoz. Today we're going to continue on with House Bill 3001. Part of that is the Trans-Canada buyout proposal. So today we have a presentation on the Trans-Alaska AKLNG participation decision. Marty Rutherford, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, will be here to present. Marty, please. And then we've got Deepa Potival, Principal Consultant for Black and Veatch. I think we'll be joining her in this. This is, 35-page presentation. Or I asked Deputy Commissioner Rutherford the length of time this would take. She felt about 35, 40 minutes. And so we'll go through the presentations and then go to questions after that if we can. Let's make sure we get through the full presentation. There was a request that we have all the questions that were asked yesterday in the Finance Committee with the answers. The department is working on that. Commissioner Rutherford assured me that we will get that as soon as we can in an effort to make sure all legislators are informed with what's going on in the committee, the questions are asked, and the answers for them. So, and if you've got further questions, just present them. With that, Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here today. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to talk about the Trans-Alaska AKLNG, Trans-Canada AKLNG participation decision. As the Chairman stated, my name is Marty Rutherford. I'm Deputy Commissioner from Department of Natural Resources, and I have with me Deepa Potival. And Deepa, do you want to introduce yourself?
Thank you, Marty. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me here. My name is Deepa Potival. I am a director with Black and Veatch. As I mentioned yesterday, Black and Veatch is involved in large infrastructure projects around the world. We focus on energy, water, telecoms, the critical human infrastructure. My area of expertise is midstream natural gas and LNG, and I have been supporting the state for about the last 10 years, starting with SGDA through AGEA, SB 138, and here we are. I'm very happy to be here and hope to answer many of the questions that came up yesterday.
Thank you. And we just received a note from staff who always keeps us in line. Today we have, both today and tomorrow, we're going to be working on through this presentation with Marty and Deepa on this, so we'll have plenty of time to go through the questions, make sure people understand this. There is more information coming besides this packet right here, so they'll be here for 2 days.
Mr. Chair, do we have to do this without lights?
Yes.
Let the staff know what you need.
Lights on. Some lights?
That's a good compromise. Yes.
I thought you were brighter than that.
Yeah. I'm with Representative Gaddis all the way on this.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just to set the stage, yesterday morning we ran through a very synthesized version of this presentation, so some of these slides will be a reiteration of what we covered yesterday. So to set the stage, back in June 2014, the State of Alaska and TransCanada Alaska entered into a key agreement that authorized TransCanada to pay the upfront capital costs and hold the State of Alaska's 25% equity share of ownership in the midstream component, specifically the gas treatment plant and the pipeline. This agreement...
Could you move the slide? Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. That agreement is called the Precedent Agreement, the PA, and it was based on the terms of the Memorandum of Understanding between the state and TransCanada, which was signed in December of 2013. The Alaska Legislature reviewed and debated the terms of that MOU during your 2014 legislative session. The state is now faced with a December 31, 2015 deadline to make a decision on whether to take or to buy back TransCanada's share of the project and have direct equity participation in the full AKLNG midstream, all three components. To do this would require that we terminate the precedent agreement. Under the PA's terms, by December 31, 2015, the state is obligated either to enter into a firm transportation services agreement, we call that, I'll often refer to that as an FTSA, to enter into a FTSA with TransCanada, or TransCanada will be able to terminate the PA. The state administration is recommending termination of the Trans-Alaska relationship by December of this year and replacing it with the state's direct participation in the entire midstream. The state administration believes this path allows the state to better manage the obligation to the midstream costs that we have, and it increases the overall economics of the project to the state, and it allows the state to have more direct voting rights on the key AKLNG investments that we are really making for our citizens.
Excuse me, Ms. Rutherford. So when we're going through this, you're going to have backup information that substantiates what we're doing here in executive summary?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we will. Thank you. So let's go on. So let's step back and review the context for the state's 2014 decision to enter into a PA with TransCanada. As you will all recall, under the AGIA framework, TransCanada was the state's licensee. And under AGIA, the work product could not be transferred to AKLNG until after the resolution of AGIA abandonment issues, which included the cost of the work products. AGIA also contained a treble damages provision, and it was in this context that the prior administration negotiated an MOU with TransCanada in 2013. And then, subsequently, the AGIA termination agreement in 2014, which allowed a transition to AKLNG, which in turn led to the state signing the precedent agreement with TransCanada. So it was that sequence that brought us here today. Entering into the PA with TransCanada gave the state a very clean off-ramp from the TransCanada relationship now, by December 31, 2015, which it did not have when it entered into the PA for the reasons I noted just above.
Mr. Rutherford, we all know PA and what that is, but there's members of the public that are watching this. So beyond AKLNG and TC, if we could not use acronyms.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So entering into the precedent agreement with TransCanada also gave the state time during the pre-FEED exercise to begin to develop its in-house capabilities in order to fully consider our option of participating directly in all the midstream components at appropriate off-ramps. Furthermore, TransCanada's work under the Alaska Gasline Inducement Act and the Alaska Pipeline Project allowed a smooth transition into pre-FEED under the Alaska AKLNG. Finally, entering into the precedent agreement with TransCanada for pre-FEED gave the state time to assess its abilities to finance its share of investment in the AKLNG without TransCanada's involvement. If you could go on to the next slide. So what are the key terms of the precedent agreement between the state of Alaska and TransCanada? TransCanada owns the state approximately 25% entitlement to the gas treatment plant and the pipeline within the AKLNG project. And they fund the upfront midstream cash calls for the state of Alaska. And finally, TransCanada is the technical lead for the pipeline during this pre-FEED component of the project. In turn, the state of Alaska committed to entering into a 20 to 25-year firm transportation service agreement with TransCanada by the end of this calendar year in order for us to pay over the long term for using the gas treatment plant and the pipeline. Thus, ultimately, the state of Alaska pays TransCanada for all of its costs, including a cost of capital at approximately 7% interest. Both the state of Alaska and TransCanada have milestones and off-ramps. But the, again, the state is always responsible for the Trans-Canada costs, regardless of off-ramps. And one of the things that Deepa Potovol will be going into later in the agreement is that sort of diagram about under what circumstances and how we pay for each of those responsibilities. So, as I said, the precedent agreement has these agreed-upon off-ramps. And what does that look like? The first of these off-ramps is the one we're dealing with now. It occurs by the end of 2015, and it requires a termination of the PA by the 31st of December 2015, at which point we must pay TransCanada development costs, which approximately $70 million, and includes the TransCanada internal costs. The second off-ramp occurs before we go from FEED into final investment decision. That second off-ramp will occur approximately by the end of December 2018, and it is expected, or it is estimated, that the cost of buying out TransCanada at that point will be around $490 million. And again, that will include TransCanada's internal costs. So what's the decision at hand? We're now faced with a really critical decision on whether to go ahead and terminate the preceding agreement with TransCanada. We have two options, as I stated before, to terminate the preceding agreement by December 31, which requires that the state reimburse TransCanada for its cost incurred to date, plus approximately 7% interest. And in doing so, the state increases our overall equity in the project and our voting rights to 25%, which very importantly equals the state of Alaska's, approximately equals the state of Alaska's share of gas. Or assuming TransCanada is willing, the other alternative is for the state of Alaska to execute the firm transportation service agreement by December 31st, 2015. In this case, TransCanada would continue to incur costs on behalf of the state of Alaska unless and until there's a termination at a later date, at which point the state will also have to fully reimburse TransCanada costs plus approximately 7% interest. So, therefore, the administration is recommending termination of the preceding agreement with TransCanada now. And there's a couple of significant reasons for doing this. We recommend termination in order to align our interests. Currently, the state of Alaska is expected to receive 25% of the gas from the project. However, while TransCanada holds their current equity participation in the midstream portion of the project on our behalf, the state only retains approximately 12.5% equity in the actual project. But if we terminate the PA, we will have an equal share of the gas and an equal share of the project. We also would increase our voting rights. Terminating the preceding agreement and increasing the state's voting rights allows the state to have a much more direct say in the decision-making process of the project. This is particularly important as we complete the pre-feed phase and move fully into feed. And we recommend terminating the preceding agreement in order to increase the state's economic benefits. The state could realize up to $400 million of additional annual net cash flow from the project. This is because the state will be able to finance the project at a cheaper cost of capital than could TransCanada. And you heard Lazard and Greengate and First Southwest speak of that yesterday. And we will talk about that more as we move through the remainder of our presentation here. At this juncture, I'm going to turn it over to Deepa for a while until we get into questions.
Thank you, Marty. So as Marty mentioned, the main drivers behind the administration's recommendation are Let's improve alignment and increase the state's voting rights and create more economic benefit to the state. And so looking at the first part of that, why is equity alignment and why are voting rights important? What this schematic shows is the structure of the project as it exists today. What you'll notice is each of the three producers, Exxon, BP, and Conoco, have a certain share of gas, and the ownership that they have in the project is represented by the boxes below, and you'll see that for each of these producers, their share of the gas equals their ownership in the project. If you look over on the right and look at the state is expected to get about 25% of the gas from the project, but because we have TransCanada holding the equity in the GTPN pipeline, effectively the state only holds the 25% equity in the LNG plant. And because the LNG plant is expected to be about half of the cost of the total project, effectively what that means is the state has about 12.5% ownership in the AKLNG project when compared to the 25% ownership that we have in the gas. Okay? And why that becomes important is the state's equity ownership in the AKLNG project will determine the state's voting rights. And effectively, we're now sharing our voting rights with TransCanada. And TransCanada's decisions are effectively driven by maximizing their own shareholder value. They're a commercial entity. They come to the project with the perspective of being a midstream infrastructure company, right, a pipeline company, whereas the state's interests are always going to be to maximize value for Alaskans from the perspective of a resource owner. And there, you know, and that creates a fundamental misalignment. And often the state and TransCanada fall on the same side of different issues, but there are several instances when TransCanada falls on a different side on an issue that is of importance to the state. And effectively, rather than being, you know, an agent of the state or an extension of the state and always voting as the state would want to vote, because, you know, we've created that equity spot for them in the project, you know, they are a commercial entity that the state has to negotiate with on different issues where we have differences of opinion on, you know, what the right decision is. Okay? And one of the main learnings in going through the pre-FEED process with TransCanada is understanding the challenges of the structure that we've set up and realizing that, you know, there is this misalignment. We don't always fall on the same side, and having TransCanada sit in that spot for the state is diluting the state's voice in the project. There are many important decisions that are coming up, and we've highlighted some of those in that little bubble there. One is the project budget and schedule. Another is different design decisions on the project, you know, pipeline GTP, and decisions related to byproduct handling at the GTP. Again, that is something that's going to have a high value for the state because there's intended to be a lot of carbon dioxide that's going to be extracted from the gas at Prudhoe, and that needs to be disposed of, and it will be a decision that is going to be influenced by whoever owns the GTP part. And for the state to be at the table to be able to influence that decision is going to be important. So those are some examples of where we've realized, you know, going through the pre-FEED experience and seeing how that relationship plays out, that it's not from any ill intent. It's simply a function of them being a different commercial entity that's trying to maximize, you know, their shareholder value versus trying to maximize the value of Alaska resources. It also creates, we've realized, complexity when it comes to setting up the governance agreements for the project. You know, for example, will TC vote on all issues that affect the GTP and the pipeline? And will AGDC vote on issues that affect the LNG plant? What if there's an issue that affects, you know, all three components, and who essentially speaks as the state's voice, you know, in the AKLNG project? Another challenge, and it's not on the slide here, is access to information. It simply doesn't work as efficiently as if the state was directly there. The quality of the information, the quantity of the information, the timing of the information that's received, there are challenges related to all of those when there's a filter between, you know, the state actually being there versus working through TransCanada as a partner in that process. Now, looking on the other side of it, in terms of the economic impact of the TC decision for the state. There's three different criteria that we're going to use to discuss the economics. The first is cash flows, and there's two components of that, the upfront cash calls that the state would have to make in the project and the operational cash flows that the state would receive from the project once it has been constructed. The second is net present value, and the third is risk elements. So the state's upfront cash calls required, if the agreement with TransCanada is terminated, are shown here in that red box. There are two immediate components to that. One is paying back TransCanada for the investment that it has made in the pre-FEED, and that is estimated to be about $70 million. The second is to now fund AGDC for continuing the work that TransCanada would have otherwise contributed to for pre-FEED, and that's estimated to be a little over $60 million. So those two would be the immediate cash calls that the state would have to make. And then we should also recognize, and then going forward, you know, the state is going to need to make direct upfront cash calls for the FEED as well as the construction of the project. So the economic trade-off is, does the state make a higher upfront investment in the project and realize higher cash flows during project operations, or do we want to make a lower upfront investment in the project and achieve lower cash flows during project operation? That fundamental trade-off has not changed since the last time you looked at the TC decision, right? The economics work out in exactly the same way. It's a trade-off between, you know, the preference for taking the upfront investment or doing it alone and achieving higher upfront investment and achieving these higher cash flows. And that's the trade-off that we're going to look at here. So looking at the first part of it, this is the upfront cash call exposure. And it's expected to be somewhere in the $7 to $8 billion range. If, you know, the $7 billion is at the base capital cost estimate of the project at about $45 billion, and if you assume there's a 20% capital cost overrun in the project and it comes in closer to $54-$55 billion, then the upfront additional investment would be closer to $8 billion. On an annual basis, you know, at its peak during construction, the state would have to fund about $1.5 billion with TC, and now without TC, that will go up to a little over $2.5 billion. One of the things that I should note here is that in terms of where the cash, the investment in the project is spent, at pre-FEED, you're spending a very small amount of the total project's investment. It's about 1% or so. When you get to the FEED, or the front-end engineering and design, you spend, you know, about 4 to 5% of the total project's cost. It's really when you get into construction. Between FEED and construction comes a decision point that's known as the final investment decision, okay? And it is after that point that the construction starts, and that's when you're really spending 95% of the total capital cost associated with the project. Now, one very important thing that will come together at FID, or final investment decision, is your financing. And so, at that point, for the project to take a final investment decision, each of the project partners will have had to have sold their LNG under long-term commitments with buyers. They will all have to line up their financing for the project, so each of them will have to figure out how they will fund the project. And third, at that point, you have your board approval, all your engineering and design is done, and you're going to kick off the contractors that will actually build this thing, okay? So for the state, before we take final investment decision for the project, the state will have financed it in the financial markets. And so these upfront cash calls we're talking about, you know, with the $7 to $8 billion upfront, in total and spread over in this profile during construction will come from, you know, whatever the source of debt is that the state has taken on to finance the project, okay? Now, looking at the other side of the cash flows, which is the operational side. Once the project is operational, it is expected that the state would receive net annual cash flows of up to $400 million without TC than with TC. And this comes from the expectation that the state has a lower cost of debt than the 7% that we're getting from TransCanada. And the state also doesn't have certain cost elements that TransCanada does in terms of its, you know, its taxes, for example. From an NPV perspective, depending on the discount rate that you choose to calculate your net present value, the state is at worst neutral, you know, if you assume a 10% discount rate, and if you assume a 5% discount rate, the state achieves value, additional value of over $1 billion on an expected basis. One of the things that I want to point out is, you know, you probably noticed that we said the state can achieve up to $400 million per year in additional net cash flows, and we wanted to share with you some sensitivities on that number, right? I said that $400 million is based on the expectation that the state can finance cheaper than TransCanada. And this sensitivity analysis is looking at what if the state's cost of debt, the cost of capital for the project, is higher than what we're expecting now. You know, yesterday you heard the gentlemen that were on the finance team talk about, you know, their opinion that the state will be able to get financing for this project. And they also shared with you, you know, at different credit ratings for the state, what the expected cost of debt would be. At A minus, I think they pointed out that it would be about 5.5%. And what these bars here show is the 360 is what has been rounded up to the $400 million. But even if we assume that the state's cost of debt climbs up and it's, you know, 5%, there's still $170 million in additional value that the state can be expected to get versus keeping TransCanada in. And so even across a wide range of interest rates, even some that, you know, are perhaps too high to really be realistic, the state would achieve additional cash flows without TransCanada. So the next question really about the decision to terminate TransCanada is, why terminate the agreement now, right? As Marty mentioned, the precedent agreement was designed to have different off-ramps for the state. It was entered into against the background of AGEA for the pre-FEED period with the recognition that, you know, as I mentioned, pre-FEED is a small part of the project's full development cost. It allows us to examine the effectiveness of the relationship with TransCanada. It helps us to understand whether the state has the financial ability to invest directly in the midstream. And the different off-ramps at the end of pre-FEED and through FEED were designed into the precedent agreement to allow the state to come to this fork in the road, evaluate the information that we have through our experience with pre-FEED, and understand whether, you know, this is the right decision for the state. So in terms of the timing of this particular off-ramp, the first main reason on why, you know, this is the off-ramp that the administration is recommending is the state's ability to manage financial risk, okay? The second is to avoid something known as back-end rights. I'm just kind of hitting, you know, the big blue boxes here, because in the next few slides I'm going to walk through each of these and explain how they work. And the third is to have the ability to influence certain key project decisions that we think are impending, okay? So the first one, the ability to manage financial risk. According to the agreement that we have, the state is always obligated to pay TransCanada's costs, okay? During the development period, that means that if the state chooses to terminate, the project terminates, TC decides to exit, any of these things happen, the state has to pay back TransCanada all of its costs, all of its development costs, internal costs, as well as a 7% interest on all of that. And so whether or not the project succeeds and moves forward through this development phase, the state has the obligation to pay back TC's costs, okay? And if you believe that, and that is true, but if you have the obligation to take on this development risk and the state can finance cheaper than TC, the earlier the state makes that termination decision, the lower the ultimate cost that the state will pay, you know, in the event of a failure leg, right? Also, today where the state stands, there's a prospect of a successful project. And that prospect of the successful project creates a much better environment for the state to go to the financing community and fund its investment in these upfront costs than, say, you know, 3 years out, and if the project is not moving forward at that point, we've invested much more in the project. In other words, TransCanada has invested much more on the state's behalf. They have accrued many more internal costs as well as interest expenses at that point, and the state will have the obligation of writing a bigger check to TransCanada, potentially with very little notice, and will need to then go to the financing community to fund that when the financing community knows that the state's prospects of a successful project have dimmed significantly. And at that point, the state's cost of being able to finance that are expected to be higher. If you go to a success leg and say, you know, we've gotten past the development risk and we keep TransCanada in, again, the state has to repay all of TransCanada's costs, except now we're repaying it in the form of a tariff payment to them, right? And because TransCanada's cost of capital is higher than what the state's is expected to be, that tariff payment will be higher than if we had just paid those midstream costs directly. And that's the value that the up to $400 million creates, okay? So either way, if there's a failure leg and you're going through this development phase, the state can do it cheaper, and it's better to manage it proactively today than try and finance it later when there's a bigger check due to TransCanada and the markets know that the project's not going forward. Or if it succeeds, you know, the state can finance this cheaper anyway. We'll just pay our midstream costs directly and achieve the $400 million of additional annual cash flows every year. Okay, so that's what supports from a managing the financial risk perspective, why this is, you know, this is the fork in the road in terms of the off-ramp that the state should consider. And I think we've covered this already, and this is essentially saying, you know, through the different stages, the stakes get higher. And if we believe that the state can do it cheaper, then doing it earlier is better than doing it later after TransCanada has accrued more costs. The second and very important reason is to avoid back-end rights for TransCanada. The precedent agreement does not have, you know, what are known as these back-end rights, because the legislature actually took it out of the original terms that were proposed, and placed in front of you during the last legislative session in 2014. And what the back-end rights essentially provide is, if the state crosses this December 2015 timeline and enters into an FTSA with TransCanada, the expected terms of that FTSA, the Firm Transportation Services Agreement, effectively say that if within 5 years of the state terminating the relationship with TransCanada, if the state pursues any substantially similar project, we have to allow TransCanada to come back into the project under similar terms, okay? Originally, the terms of the precedent agreement were supposed to have that back in right, but the legislature said, no, we want to give the state a clean off-ramp once we've evaluated how this works through pre-feed. And, you know, it's only if, you know, we've gone from dating to engagement at that point will we give you that back in right, right? So this clean off-ramp was designed to allow the state to make that clean break if that's what the decision was. And then the third reason is, as I mentioned, there are several key near-term AKLNG decisions that are impending. And because there's, you know, a fundamental difference between the state's interests and, definitely the producers and often the TransCanada's interests, we fall on different sides of, you know, issues. And being able to terminate the agreement with TransCanada and gain our full voting rights equal to the 25% share that that we have in the project will help us to have a much more direct influence over key decisions, including, you know, byproduct handling, project budget, and schedule. And it's also expected to facilitate a simpler and more efficient resolution of, you know, voting rights and various terms in the governance agreements that are currently being negotiated. I'm going to skip this next section. We included it originally from the perspective of, you know, for the sake of completion. You've walked through this with the finance team yesterday, and it's essentially a repetition of that.
We will come back to that later.
The other question that's out there is, how can the state replace TransCanada's technical role in the project? Yes, TC is experienced in northern pipelines. It's one of the values that they brought to the project. And they currently lead the pipeline technical work for AKLNG. And in its current role, TC performs several functions, and that includes holding the state's midstream equity and being the signatory to the joint venture agreement for pre-feed. It contributes pipeline subject matter experts that are seconded to the joint venture project management team. It helps to coordinate the FERC NEPA process, which is the environmental review process. And how will we replace all of that without TransCanada? One thing that's really important for us to understand is that TransCanada is not anticipated to actually build the pipeline. Okay? The AKLNG structure is set up such that there is what is known as the project management team, or the PMT, and that team leads and guides the AKLNG project. It is made up of experts from each of the different project partners, and they hold different positions based on their experience and the skill that they contribute. The project management team, in turn, it hires the engineering and specialist contractors that are advancing the design efforts now, and it will hire the engineering, procurement, and construction contractors that will actually eventually build the project. And so that is the structure under which the AKLNG project is progressing. You know, it's not a separate pipeline company where TransCanada was supposed to build the pipeline. It falls under the broad umbrella of the AKLNG. It's managed by the AKLNG project management team, and the work is done by a combination of, you know, supervision by that PMT and a layer of contractors that implement it. Needless to say, you know, the quality of the partners that we have here, the AKLNG project partners, each bring significant experience to the project. And in addition, AGDC has, you know, a lot of Alaska-related pipeline experience because of their successful completion of the pre-feed as well as feed work on the ASAP pipeline. And AGDC has already taken over TransCanada's role in coordinating the FERC NEPA process. And so really it's going to be that combination that we're seeing on the right there, the AKLNG producer parties, AGDC, the contractors that get hired in, that will all come together under that PMT structure to, you know, build the GTP and pipeline as well as the LNG plant for the project. So in conclusion, the current agreement with TransCanada, the precedent agreement, was designed to provide the state as well as TransCanada with several off-ramps as the project moved through its different development stages. This important one at the end, you know, at the end of December 2015 was designed to be a clean off-ramp for the state without any back-end rights for TransCanada. The administration is recommending terminating the TC relationship by December 2015 and replacing it with the state's direct participation in the AKLNG midstream. And the exercise of this off-ramp and the recommendation is based on the fact that it will help to to create better alignment and control for the state. It will help the state lower and manage its financial risk in the project more actively, and that it's expected to create additional value for the state because of our lower cost of debt. So with that, Mr. Chairman, we'll take any questions at this point.
Thank you. I think for the members, not just the members of finance, but the members of the House, this is a lot of information here. So what I'd like to do is we'll ask members to go through their questions today. We don't have a time limit on today, so we'll go until we feel everybody's answers for the questions for the day are done. But what I'd like to do is allow members to go back, read through this again, absorb it, allow other members of the legislature to be able to get questions to co-chairs Thompson or my office, and we'll come back tomorrow morning or tomorrow afternoon with this presentation before we start something new to make sure everybody is understanding of what we've got going on here and our questions are done. That good,
Mr. Chairman.
With that,
Mr. Chairman, I neglected to note something when we started the presentation. We also provided to you in your packets today what we're calling the Trans-Canada AKLNG participation decision primer. And it's a follow-on to the Black and Veatch report, the Trans-Canada Participation Decision Report that was issued on September 30th. This was issued on the 24th of yesterday. It basically is a narrative that walks you through that November 30 report by Black and Veatch. And it walks through this presentation as well. So it's a very useful sort of it's not as driven by the analytical charts that were in the Black and Veatch report, more of a narrative.
Thank you, Ms. Rutherford. And so what we'll do, we did not receive this information, I believe it was about 2:38 this afternoon. Not good enough. So what we'll do is we'll allow members to take this back, go through it, and then if we have questions on that tomorrow, see that we'll do that. But
appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we dive into the details of the advantages and disadvantages, I need to ask Deputy Commissioner Rutherford a question. Under SB 138, help me understand, remind people watching, who has the authority to make the termination decision for TransCanada, and where is that decision laid out?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that decision is laid out in the precedent agreement. I will note that the precedent agreement is a confidential document. However, TransCanada, we had requested that TransCanada make that document public. They have done so, and I think they are going to be distributing it within the next 24 hours. But the decision is the decision of the Commissioner of Natural Resources. The Commissioner and the Governor felt strongly that they did not want to just terminate the preceding agreement without having the discussion with the legislature so that you became a party to the decision and the associated appropriation, which would be mandated by a termination.
If I may, because we were our party to the determination, your words, the confidentiality agreements, at some point we've been trying to work through the administration as legislators, we should maybe have access to some of those, that information.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, yes, and that's why we encouraged TransCanada to make the preceding agreement public, and they have agreed to. It is, I think there is one area that's slightly redacted, very small portion of one sentence, but other than that, they are making it public. That was not something that the state executive could do without their approval, but they have agreed to it, so you will be getting that direct information, I believe, directly from TransCanada.
Will the legislature have access to all the confidentiality agreements?
That is the confidential document that drives the arrangement that emerged from the MOU. Yes.
Thank you. I appreciate hearing that it's actually the Commissioner of DNR's decision to terminate or not. What's the mechanism? Would that be a best interest finding? And can we get a copy of that before we actually evaluate whether to appropriate the money for that?
Representative Sadler, through the chair. No, it's actually a contractual arrangement that can be terminated with just a swipe of the pen.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Representative Wilson, Guttenberg, and Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we keep hearing that we want to sit at the table, which I agree. So who exactly will be sitting at the table? Will it be, you know, the administration, or will it be, you know, who exactly will it be that will be at the table representing our interest?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. It would be AGDC, Alaska
Gas Line
Development Corporation. Sorry, I'm so used to that. Saying AGDC. They would be the state's representative. They would hold the 25% equity position for all three elements of the AKLNG project. They already hold the liquefaction. They would add to this the 25% position in the pipeline and the gas treatment plant.
So follow up, sir?
So
if you ask, only
I try to
go ahead, I'll let you ask
whenever
it.
Possible. I know it's hard. So when you're talking about, you know, the AKLNG producer partners, so I'm assuming we're talking about the three producers that was on page 34. So that would be Exxon, BP, and Conoco, that they would be sitting at the table. And then it would be a designee or the head that would be sitting there with them, besides TransCanada, instead of TransCanada.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes, it would be AGDC, either whomever they determine would be their voice at that table. AGDC was set up by the legislature to be the equity holder, at least for the liquefaction, and so they would be the state's representative on the project for the state of Alaska instead of TransCanada holding the two elements of the project.
Thank you. And I have one last question that doesn't quite follow this.
On that point, if I could,
Representative. Go right ahead.
Where in 138 does AKLNG have statutory authority to continue work on the pipeline and the gas treatment plant?
Mr. Chairman, I do not have that at hand, but actually I was looking at it a few minutes ago. It is in 138. It is referenced. I believe that question was asked of the administration earlier today, and I believe that the Attorney General's office is reviewing that and will be giving a response directly from the Governor's office.
Sooner's better than later.
Yes, sir.
Representative Wilson.
Okay, and one other thing. So on the PILT, changing directions a little bit, if TransCanada is no longer our partner and they would have been paying into this PILT, into the municipalities, does that whole thing go away? Because now the state of Alaska will be the one, or will any of the other three partners be paying into the PILT?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, while we are not the experts on the payment in lieu of taxes, I have had a conversation with the Department of Revenue on this issue. As I understand it, and I certainly can be corrected by anyone who is in the audience for revenue, as I understand it, the calculation was made with a 4-4, you know, there would be four partners, four quarters of the total, and if in fact the TransCanada buyout occurs, then it would be a 3/4, but the same amount of money would simply be divided among the municipalities so that they don't have a lower total income based upon the TransCanada leaving the party, and maybe Deepa would like to add something. Let us double check that, though. We do have some slight difference of opinion between us, so we will double check that and get back to you with a specific response tomorrow.
If you could just send it to the co-chair so they can make sure we all
will indeed.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Rutherford, you just mentioned that you've had a slight difference of opinions on a specific question. Can you get us? I'm trying to get both sides of this discussion. So if you've got different opinions on that, get us the discussion that's happened or some information of what are the alternatives that you're looking at.
Actually, it was between Deepa and I that I just said that. And actually, Deepa, would you like to explain how you see it at this juncture, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Well, you don't have to do that right now if you want to just get it to something in writing on what we've got so we can analyze it.
Yeah, my answer was just going to be that each of the producer parties would continue to pay the PILT
And that does not change, you know, with TC's exit.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we have Representative Guttenberg, Guerra Munoz, Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. David. Chair. And there's certainly a lot here to digest and to ask questions about. The first question, I just want to make sure we get on a level playing field and we understand, because I know a lot of people have this question. If we do nothing, the state still has liability for all the work that TransCanada does, and it keeps going forward, and we have to pay them whatever happens, and we're not terminating, we don't have the ability to terminate the project, that if we do nothing, TransCanada keeps working, and we are liable for whatever that is. Am I correct?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair. We are responsible for TransCanada's costs no matter whether they quit, we terminate them, or the project terminates. We either pay them, under those three circumstances, their costs plus 7% interest, or we enter into a firm transportation service agreement and repay their costs over a 20 to 25-year firm transportation service agreement with associated with throughput.
Thank you. If I may.
And just to clarify, Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, the state has the, you know, the right to stop participating in the AKLNG project, and if the state chooses to do that, you know, TransCanada will not be incurring additional costs on the state's behalf. I don't know if I heard you ask that question, but if you did, you know, the state absolutely has the right to terminate its participation in AKLNG, and that will terminate, you know, TransCanada's future work on the project.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just clarify, though, in that circumstance, we would still owe TransCanada their costs to date, plus the interest.
If I may, Mr. Chair. So if we terminate the agreement with TransCanada, we owe them 7% of the money, or we owe 7% on top. And that includes whatever cost of capital that TransCanada itself has accrued to pay for whatever they're doing.
That's correct, Representative Guttenberg. Right,
so we can in the scenario of we terminate them, or regardless of whether we terminate them or not, or we keep our relationship intact, what parameters do we have to understand what it is that we're paying for? Is it a straight billing contract? You know, are we paying for, and this came up a few years ago, are we paying for their gardener in the home headquarters, or are we just paying direct costs, not incidental costs?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, that too is part of the proceeding agreement that you will be provided by TransCanada. But I will say that it is associated with a billing, and we have audit prerogatives.
Okay. And if I may, Mr. Chair, continue. On page four, thank you. On page four, entering into the PA with TransCanada, the second bullet down. Well, I guess from the second section. It was to give the state time during pre-FEED to develop the in-house capabilities in order to fully consider the options to directly participate in midstream and all appropriate off-ramps. Have we got there yet? Have we developed the capacity? Have we developed or hired the staff? Do we have the people on board to actually at this point follow through with what we need to be doing? Or are we still developing in-house capabilities?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I believe that, in fact, we have a much better understanding of what the relationship is as an equity owner now that we've begun to enter into some of the commercial negotiations and participated in the project management team oversight of the project. And I believe that that AGDC feels very comfortable in that in holding our equity position as the state's representative. So yes, I believe we have.
So for now, thank you, Mr.
And I'd like to mention say thank you to members, being courteous and how long you take answering questions so we make sure everybody has time and equal time. I appreciate that. I think we all do. Representative Garamuño Sadler's Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Potavola, let me ask you your opinions, and if I have time, I'll get to Deputy Commissioner Rutherford, but she'll be around much longer. If
good to hear.
I think it's my uninformed opinion. So I have two concerns, and if the questions are cloudy, the answer on the bill becomes more cloudy for me. If the questions are clear, or the answers are clear, my view on the bill becomes much more clear. Let's first go to whether the state makes more money by getting rid of TransCanada. There's been an estimate that if this project succeeds, the state will make up to $360-400 million a year. If that's 20 years, that's somewhere between $3.5 and $8 billion if we get rid of TransCanada. But is that extra $400 million a year that we make, and you showed all the scenarios what we might make, but let's just say an extra $200 to $400 million per year for shorthand, is that what we make clear of our original $7.1 billion investment? So what I'm asking is, we invest $7.1 billion, we get that money back, and then on top of that we get the $200 to $400 million a year, or does that $200 to $400 million a year go to pay back the original $7.1 billion investment?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, thank you for that question. It's a really good question. The $200 to $400 million per year would be net of all of the state's costs, and it would be on, you know, in your words, it would be on top of, it would be after the repayment of the original $7 billion additional investment that the state would have made. As I said, the state is expected to borrow that additional $7 billion and would have, you know, a debt repayment obligation during the project's operation. And the $200 to $400 million of additional cash flows that we're estimating are after those debt payments have been met. And so it's after the original, it's beyond what the original $7 billion investment is. So it's incremental.
So I'll just, you'll tell me if I'm wrong, and then I'll ask my next question, but and you can tell me after the question. But so it's it seems like it's a clear $200 to $400 million roughly that we get, and it doesn't get and then we don't have to subtract the original $7.1 billion.
That's correct, okay. Representative Guerra.
Now, this legislature, the state's filled with people who are optimists about a gas pipeline succeeding and pessimists and people in between. So let's say the project fails. If we ended this project today, I think that would be a mistake, but if we ended this project today and we pass this bill and we buy out TransCanada, that doesn't cost us any more money than if we don't pass this bill. Is that correct? It's the same amount of money if we do this today regardless?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, yes, that is correct. The state has the obligation to pay back TransCanada regardless.
Okay, and then through the chair. If one or two or three or 4 years down the road this project fails, does it save the state money to buy out TransCanada because we're not paying TransCanada's 7% additional interest and their financing costs? So for the people who believe this project is going to fail 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years down the road, is it your opinion that we save money by buying out TransCanada because we don't have to pay that 7%, what I consider a penalty or what's called interest?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, yes is the short answer, that the state would effectively, assuming the project fails 1, 2, 3, 4 years down the line, the state would be writing a smaller check for its participation up to that point in time without TransCanada than with TransCanada. And that is because, as you pointed out, we're accruing a 7% interest on the feed and pre-feed costs with TransCanada, and we believe that the state can finance cheaper than that based on the work that the finance team has presented to you.
Through the chair. So now I just want to see if I'm missing anything. So if the project fails and we buy out TransCanada and pass this bill, if the project fails, we save more money, we lose less money. If the project succeeds, we earn more money. It seems too easy, but is that your opinion of what happens?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, yes. Assuming the state can finance cheaper than 7.1%, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. excuse me. Has there been any non-alignment issues to date between the state of Alaska and TransCanada? And if so, what are the issues?
Representative Thompson, through the chair, some of the things that make some of these discussions difficult are the fact that we're in negotiations under the AKLNG, and there is a confidentiality agreement in place on us. I am not able to go into any detail, but there have been some difficulties because we have different commercial perspectives. I wouldn't say they have been extreme, but I will say that there have been some, yes.
One example we can possibly give you, Representative Thompson, through the chair, is without getting into specifics, like I said, the access to information is an area that we find challenging simply because, you know, we don't get it directly. It has to work through a partner.
So, Ms. Rutherford, we're trying to keep the committee members and everybody as informed as possible. So I'd like to know, I'm sure what Representative Thompson's trying to get at is, what are those differences? What are the issues? What are the problems? What is the relationship with the state of Alaska with TC? Is it good, bad? Where is it good? Where is it bad? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, you're following right along the line there.
Mr. Chairman, it is fair to say, as Deepa referred to during her presentation, that governance is a perfect example of that because obviously there's lack of clarity on who would get to vote on AKLNG if you have a split ownership between TransCanada and AGDC. That, you know, obviously if AGDC is fronting the state's money and participating in the project, they would want the vote. The state of Alaska, because it has the liquefaction and, it, you know, would want the vote. So those are the kind of issues where there has been differences of opinion.
Go ahead, Representative Thomas.
Not on that one. I'm going to change a little bit. In the Black and Veatch report, it talks about that the state gas team and AGDC are participants in the regulatory process and commercial negotiations with the producers. The state gas team and AGDC using legal resources and SMEs were appropriate for support on the project expansion and third-party access issues. Who is the state gas team? I don't know who they are. I keep seeing this reference, but I have no idea who's the state gas team.
And what roles they play.
And what role do they play, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thompson through the chair, I could give you a list of names and whether they are under contract or are within the various agencies, or I could try to tell you here. I think it would probably be better for us to write it down.
Please do.
And provide you that information.
And then also, how do they interact with AGDC and the decision-making process if it's a combination of the state gas team and AGDC?
Mm-hmm.
If you can get me that information then, please, in writing, get it to Co-Chair Newman, and make sure we get it out to the people.
Representative Thompson, we'll do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just on that point, Mr. Rutherford, is there anything specific that lays out who the project team members are and what their specific duties are?
Mr. Chairman, may I ask for clarification on that? The project, as in AKLNG project, or the state gas team?
Oh.
We will get you that. Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. My questions are very similar to Representative Thompson's questions. Primarily, the first question would be, do you believe that the TransCanada has fulfilled its obligations under the pre-feed process?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, absolutely. Yeah, they have been they have done exactly what they said they were going to do. Yes.
Okay.
Go ahead, Representative.
And then could you also elaborate on TransCanada's position on, say, well, first of all, I'm curious if you know what their position is on the expanded pipeline size going from 42 inches to 48 inches. I know that the administration is exploring a change in pipeline size. Do you know whether or not TransCanada supports that position?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, the project, the AKLNG project, has supported adding the work associated with fully analyzing a 48-inch pipe versus a 42 as part of their final pre-feed effort, and that required all parties voting to support that. So, yes, they did.
Can I follow up on that point then, on the decision that the financial decision that we make, does it include the expansion, the additional money required of the expansion decision?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, that it is not a decision so much as a commitment by the project to bring a 48-inch analysis up to the same level of pre-feed information as the 42-inch pipeline. So it will allow the project and its equity owners to make an informed decision about which is the appropriate pipe size.
Okay.
Go ahead,
if I can, on that point then, is what is the price or what is the expected budget for reviewing that decision or leading up to the decision point?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, I'm trying to remember if it's 30. Is it 30? Yeah, for that incremental piece of the additional analysis, it's $30 million.
Okay, and then is our portion of that $30 million part of the money being requested in the legislation?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, yes, it is.
Okay. And just instead of going to the bill, if you could just give us numbers as we go along, I think the more times we hear that, the better off we'll be.
And, Mr. Chair, I just have two final questions. I'm curious the level of involvement TC has in terms of the employees dedicated to this project. Do you have any sense on how many individuals from TransCanada are actively working on this project?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, I believe the number is 15.
And then one final question. If, for whatever reason, the buyout did not happen at this point, what happens with that relationship with TransCanada?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, the in discussions with TransCanada, they have noted and said that we are free to discuss the fact that they have offered, they are willing to offer the AKLNG project what the project field are critical employees to complete free feed, to continue their, to secunda them to the project.
Go ahead, Representative.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. But more specifically, I was curious in terms of the relationship between the state and TransCanada, if this arrangement is not approved, the buyout, what happened? What is the impact of that decision on forward movement on the project?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, I believe you will hear from TransCanada that they are now supportive of the state buying out their position, and I think that is their preference, although I know they will be in available for discussion with the legislature at a hearing later this week. But I believe I asked them directly what I should say, and that is what they said to me, that they are supportive of this administration buying out their position.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Munoz. Representative Gaddis, Sadler, Edgman, Garrett, Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when SB 138 was passed, there seemed to be a lot of value in bringing TransCanada into the deal. So we've spoken a lot of the reason that we want to buy them out. But what are we losing by buying them out? I mean, there's certainly an upside and a downside, and we've spent today talking the upside. What is the downside?
Representative Gattis, through the chair. Well, obviously, the downside is we don't want to lose any momentum on the pre-FEED work, and the fact that TransCanada has agreed to either seconda or allow the project to hire their people to finish that work, that is probably the biggest risk. So I think we've dealt with it, and TransCanada has been most obliging in assisting us with that.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and as I heard, we'll be hearing from TransCanada as well, so thank you.
Thank you.
Just because it's on that point, Ms. Poudreval, you said that this was a good transaction, and I want to get a little deeper into what Representative Gattis was trying to get to. Nothing in this world is perfect, and you talked about the relationships there, so if we could get a little bit deeper into not just what all the great points were of separating us out and why the department did this, but what problems did you see arising out of this? What issues did you have to try and conquer? What issues do you think were concerns to the state? Those are things that we need to know to help have the whole story. You ran into those problems as you were going through this, but we don't ever get that information. You didn't have any of that information in here, and that's what we need to know. I think that's more or less what Representative Gattis was trying to get to also, and I think all the other members I know I've talked to have the same concerns.
Mr. Chair, I shared with you one, like I said, you know, there are some constraints just because of confidentiality, but I want to really help you understand where the misalignments, you know, are. Like I said, access to information is one area that we have definitely found, you know, is challenging with that extra layer between us and the project. Okay, so that's... that's one. Second is, and you know, I will give this to you as an example. I mentioned byproduct handling as one of the impending issues that are coming up, where it would be very important for the state to, you know, have its direct seat at the table. The issue there is there's a substantive amount of CO2, carbon dioxide, that will have to be extracted from the Prudhoe gas. It is the expectation that that CO2 will then be reinjected in the Prudhoe Bay unit. And there need to be negotiations about how the costs associated with the byproduct handling will be negotiated effectively with the Prudhoe Bay unit. It can be done on a bilateral basis between each of the parties that are, you know, bringing that gas in, or it can be done from the prospect of the AK LNG project negotiating with the Prudhoe Bay unit. That is another example where, from TransCanada's perspective, you know, any cost that is incurred would simply be a pass-through because it would flow through to the state as a tariff element. From the state's perspective, you know, we're talking about billions of dollars. And so there's an example of where TransCanada's interests are different from the state's interests. And, you know, the best way to protect the state's interests is just be there and do it directly.
Ms. Rutherford, if you could just kind of get us some of the issues that you looked at and how you weighted those issues as far as concerns of the state or TC.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, I will.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a brief follow-up to my earlier question and a couple other questions, but Deputy Commissioner Rutherford, earlier you had said, I asked about when the termination mechanism would be. You said it was a contractual provision that can be changed with a stroke of a pen. I'd like to see that when it signed. When do you anticipate being able to provide us with that?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, it has not been signed. We have not terminated TransCanada because the Commissioner of Natural Resources and the Governor felt it was not an appropriate thing to do without having the engagement with the legislature on the appropriation. So that has not occurred.
Okay. The process we're going to go through the next several days or weeks is going to be that discussion, but I still anticipate getting that determination. My question is, will we get that contract signature? Excuse me, too much coffee today. Can we get that contract signed before we do the appropriation vote?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, the administration is not inclined to terminate the precedent agreement without having the legislature agreeing to the appropriation.
That's, through the chair, the follow-up. That seems to be putting the cart before the horse. My understanding is if it's the commissioner and he's sitting back there, if it's his decision to terminate, only then does it become the legislature's decision to appropriate the money or not. And do I have that wrong? Or?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, yes, he could have done that. However, he did not feel that obligating the state to approximately $70 million without having this discussion first was the appropriate thing to do. Yes, he has that authority, but no, he did not want to exercise it without having this discussion.
So the question arises, what happens if the legislature declines to vote for this appropriation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sadler, we would begin to explore the firm transportation service agreement with TransCanada.
Could I take another line of questions?
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. We talked about, there's several issues you mentioned, Deputy Commissioner, about various provisions that talk about the precedent agreement. You said there's been a willingness by TransCanada to make that public. I can't wait to get my eyes on that precedent agreement. Can you help me get eyes on that, please?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, yes, I can. I actually have asked TransCanada to transmit it or to tell us to transmit it as quickly as possible.
I look forward to that. Great. Thank you. I would push if I could.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Another topic is the voting rights. There were a couple slides in your presentation about the voting rights and how terminating TransCanada's participation would give the state a bigger seat at the table. What is the actual voting mechanism? Would we be going from one vote out of five to one vote out of four? And how does that materially change the state's bargaining power?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sadler, let us write that out because neither one of us can remember off the cuff whether this is a confidential issue. Please.
Sure enough.
Thank you.
And I won't be big. I'll come back later. Thanks, sir.
Okay, thank you. We'll keep you in the queue here. I want to try and make sure people are comfortable in this committee, are comfortable with the questions that they have. You know, we'll have plenty of time, so we will come back if we need to. Representative Edgem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the bill that we're debating is all two pages, House Bill 3001. But on page two, there's a component that totals about $13 million for three different state agencies. And Ms. Pitney told us yesterday that that money had ties to legal contracts and bankability work and things of that nature going forward. But what happens if this bill fails to pass? What does that do in an overall sense in terms of the state's momentum? Maybe just some comments on the importance of this money in terms of administration and AGDC going forward at this point.
Representative Edgman, through the chairs. There are, as you point out, different elements to the appropriation bill. There's the element to buy out TransCanada. There's the element of funding AGDC's ability to pick up the final pre-feed costs and their operational costs. And then there's the piece that funds the Department of Law, the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Natural Resources roles in the commercial aspects of the negotiations. Those include everything from fiscals to fiscal, as some people describe it, fiscal certainty, to upstream cost allocations, to ensuring that the state, because we're not a working interest owner in either the Point Thompson unit or the Prudhoe Bay unit, we actually have the gas available to sell and supply on a regular basis. If, in fact, we did not get the appropriations to finish up
this portion of the fiscal year, because ours are the remainder of this fiscal year, it would greatly affect our ability to continue the negotiations and bring the legislature commercial agreements as quickly as we are able.
So,
follow up, Representative Edgman.
Yeah, thank you. So I think what I heard you say is it would be a setback.
Representative Edgman, through the chair, it would be a significant setback. Might I just note, for instance, that Department of Natural Resources in the previous, when we put our budget together for the gas commercialization efforts, we had requested, I think, $13 million. We were funded slightly under $9 million. With the note, in discussions with various finance representatives and senators, that should we need the additional money to come back in a supplemental request. That is, in fact, what we're doing, and I think that is what the other two agencies are doing as well.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead, Representative Edgman.
My last question actually ties into the response that you just provided, and that is, again, theoretically, this bill fails to pass. The DNR commissioner elects to terminate TransCanada's participation through the precedent agreement. The bill will come later, and my question would be, what's the amount of time that the legislature would have to deal with those fiscal implications, or would that be, come forward in a supplemental bill as you just described otherwise?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, yes, that's a very good question. Again, this is actually part of the confidential proceeding agreement, but since they are releasing it, I feel comfortable enough sharing that. I think that the TransCanada has up to 30 days to provide the state with a billing, and then we have up to 90 days to pay that at their the costs, so we can challenge those costs, and we can obviously audit after following, but we have up to 90 days to pay their cost plus their 7%. After 120 days, the interest rate goes up to 10% plus LIBOR, and I think last Friday LIBOR was about 0.182, so approximately 10.2% interest after the 120th day.
I guess my final question would be...
Sorry, Representative Edgman, through the chair, if I can just add to what Marty said. The payment due date, if TransCanada issued a termination notice to us or the commissioner chooses to terminate, the payment date would be 30 days after that notice is provided. And then 90 days after that, as Marty mentioned, the state would start incurring a penalty at LIBOR plus 10.
So, and I think really the point is that what Deepa was trying to clarify is if, in fact, the day after the termination was received by TransCanada, they gave us the billing, then the 90 days start. So the 120th is the longest period of time that could be.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, for one final question. I was just thinking through as I was listening to the responses that, my questions sort of had a theoretical basis to them, but I thought I had heard you say earlier that something to the effect that, if this whole effort failed, House Bill 3001, for whatever reason, that the administration would then go forward in pursuing the FTSA with TransCanada. So my questions, in some effect, are not applicable, or at least the larger question about the precedent agreement and so forth.
Okay. Next we have Representative Guerra, followed by Representative Guttenberg and Wilson.
Can I get the camera?
Thank you. Through the chair, I guess these are for you, Ms. Rutherford, though, Deepa, if you disagree or have anything in addition, I'd like to hear that, too. Representative Munoz started talking about the possibility of a 48-inch pipe, and I remember that Mr. Balash and Mr. Pulaski, when they were working for the Parnell administration, were pushing a 48-inch pipe, assuming with the caveat that they felt that we'd be able to fill it. So... and I've always been one that doesn't believe in sort of Exxon, BP, and Conoco monopolization of the North Slope. And so with a 42-inch pipe instead of a 48-inch pipe, there's a certain amount of inexpensive expansion, and then at some point the expansion becomes very expensive and we risk not being allowed, not having competitors on the North Slope. Is that fair to say, or is that not?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, a 42-inch pipe will be expandable, but we believe, the administration and the gas team believes, that the 48-inch pipe would be a better opportunity for expansion opportunities for third parties on the North Slope, because the operational costs for the fuel gas will actually offset the additional cost of the pipe within 12 years. Now, part of the discussion at the project level is whether those premises are true. So part of the reason for bringing the 48-inch pipe up to the same level of information as the 42-inch pipe is to make that determination with informed information so that we're not just talking about different experts having different opinions.
Through the chair.
Go ahead, Representative Guerra, but if we can on that point, Mr. Rutherford, there's a break point on your economics on compression and the amount of money it costs for additional compression and that break point and the value of that. So if you could provide that information to us.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to do so, but again, that will be based upon the analysis within the gas team, and it will not be a project representation since, you know, the project will not say that's their assumption yet until they have done the studies.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Rutherford, and I understand that, you know, you wouldn't want to build a pipe if you didn't think the gas was there, so I appreciate that it's being studied. But if the conclusion is that enough gas is there to support a 48-inch pipe plus expansion, us sort of saying a 42-inch pipe is what we want, that would increase the chances that we just have basin control on the North Slope, Conoco, BP, and Exxon, and then we would deter further exploration, the further jobs, the additional revenue, the additional gas that would go through the pipeline. Is that fair, or am I missing something?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, that has certainly always been the Department of Natural Resources perspective. We are, as the agency that manages your resources, we've always been advocates for opening up opportunities for third parties and additional gas, because we believe strongly that is in the state's best interest. There is no question in our minds that when you are a resource owner up on the North Slope already, you're going to try to right-size the pipe for your own resources. So having the tension between the resource owner wanting to have an upscale pipe or an easily expandable pipe is a natural and probably healthy discussion.
Mr. Chair, there will be another day to talk about the size of the pipe, so I think I'm
I think just done. To follow up on that, though, I think it would help committee members know any information that you may have from Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission on offtake and the effects on the amount of that offtake and oil production as they move along.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we can, as you know, and AOGCC has recently made new offtake orders for both Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, so we'll be glad to provide that.
Thank you. I knew they did. Okay, Representative Gutberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to talk about or ask questions about the wall thickness of the pipe. I'm going to try and talk about TransCanada. When I think about TransCanada and our relationship with them, and they, it just seems like they have no skin in the game. Every dime they spent on this project, we reimburse them. So in the world of a partner which has no risk, their thought pattern would go downsizing or changing parameters is not a problem for them. All they would think about is how can we make more money. If we fail, we get reimbursed. If we and it doesn't cost us anything. If we succeed, there's more upside. Is that a true assessment of? And so when they're sitting at the table voting for us or making decisions at the management team, would that be a consideration that you guys made about our relationship with them?
Representative Gutenberg to the chair. That is correct. Your characterization of the, you know, the current agreement with TransCanada and the expected FTSA, any costs that are incurred as part of the project expenses would simply be pass-throughs to the state eventually. And so, you know, that is something that we need to be aware of and that influences our recommendation.
Yeah, and if I may, another one, just two more questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So the difference between us terminating...
Sorry, Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, can I clarify on one thing? And I think maybe because the agreement is going to be made public here, it's okay to do that. On the AKLNG work product and budget, you know, the actual capital that's needed to keep the project going, the state does have the ability to influence TransCanada's vote on that one area.
Okay, thank you. So we've talked a lot about the state's responsibility if we terminate the agreement. We just briefly mentioned the fact that they can do it as well. What is the difference? What are our liabilities or what do we have to pay or not pay if they're the ones that terminate the agreement versus what we if we terminate? What's the timeline? What's the change of it, if there's a difference in interest rates or penalties? I know you're opening up the agreement and things that are were confidential earlier today.
Representative Gutenberg through the chair. Again, this is covered under the terms of the confidential precedent agreement, which TransCanada has agreed to release. One of the fundamental differences if the state terminates versus TransCanada terminating is if TransCanada terminates the agreement, Deputy Commissioner Rutherford mentioned, we would have about 30 days when the payment due to them would be due. During that period, we will still be accruing interest at a 7.1% rate. And if the state hasn't made its termination amount payment within 90 days of that due date, then we start accruing interest at a higher percentage, which is the LIBOR plus 10%. Marie, correct me if I'm wrong, but if the state terminates, if we don't make the payment within the 30-day payment date, then the LIBOR plus 10 actually starts accruing right away.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I actually don't think that's correct. I think okay.
We'll have the lawyers answer that for you rather than trying to play lawyers here.
Well, just on that point, for clarity for the members and all involved here, can we get a chart that lines that out with the dates, the numbers, and the information that we need? I mean, then we can follow along with something.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we'll put that together and we'll make sure it shows any distinction between if the state terminates versus if TransCanada terminates.
That help, David?
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Wilson, Sadler, Kawasaki, Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So earlier we were asking questions of the commissioner, but the commissioner isn't sitting here. Is there a reason why we just can't directly ask him why he just didn't sign off and then ask for the money? Because they made a decision on the pipe size without asking us, so... I mean, if there's a reason he can't come to the table, that's fine. I'm just curious.
Certainly welcome to come forward, Commissioner. Even though he forgot his tie today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have a specific question for the Commissioner, Representative Wilson?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question that came up earlier, you know, why you didn't sign off on it, because... Really, we put the legislation in place to take the politics out of it. I know that's hard to believe, but, you know, now we seem to be, like, right back in the middle of it again. So, you know, I would like to know why now you would not do that if it was in the best interest of the state.
Thank you, Representative Wilson, to the chair. There are several reasons. The first reason is
again, there's an appropriate time to terminate that optimizes the state's position and value of that termination. That's December 31st of 2015. That date is up in the future. So I would not want to presume that termination until I was confident we could fund. Again, if there's failure to fund it, then we're going to pay the interest as well. So having the confidence, knowing that we had a special session, it's very appropriate to understand whether it's the will of the legislature to fund it or not. Because, again, one of the acts in the bill itself doesn't provide sufficient funding. Our budgets have not provided sufficient funding. In fact, as Deputy Commissioner Rutherford pointed out, because of the last year's budget cycle, we don't even have sufficient funding to get through this year without a supplemental budget. We cannot fund the work plan and development. That's part of this budget as well. We default on many fronts. So it's a matter of timeliness and appropriateness of process, and also out of respect for the legislative bodies, being the funding body, being the investment body. Secondly, this is a judgment call in the end. You've seen the pluses and minuses. I think they've been accurately laid out. On an NPV basis, this decision makes a lot of sense for us. We've shown the value to the state. We've shown the other non-direct financial value of this decision and states having more authority. I think it's a good decision and the right decision. And then finally, the relationship with TransCanada has been developing over time. Their willingness or desire for termination also has become apparent more recently. So for multiple reasons, it is apparent this is the best decision to make. But again, from a timely standpoint, it's a decision to make on December 31st of this year to optimize its value to the state. And again, if we don't have the funding in place, we incur a significant liability to the state and of additional penalties and payments because there is no funding mechanism till the regular session, which then leads us to a point of paying that extra interest on the money. So hopefully that answers your question. Thank
you. Representative Wilson.
And I follow up on that one, Mr. Chair. So I just want to make sure we get on record. Oops, sorry.
Name and affiliation.
Oh, excuse me. For the record, Mark Myers, Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Okay. And thank you very much. Okay, so you could have come just with a funding bill, but you came with the whole thing. And that's okay. But so I just want to make sure, because I really do want to get the politics out. This should be ran as a business and not kind of ping-ponged around politically. So if we make this decision, let's assume that we make the decision and TransCanada's out of it. AGDC is our representation at that point. So if I understand it correctly from earlier, AGDC, whoever their representative, will be at the table with the other threes. And then after that point, basically the only part that we will play will be whether or not to fund, you know, the next level that comes to us. You would bring back, someone would bring back to us, I would assume AGDC, saying we have finished this process, and to go forward, this is how much it's going to cost. And we fund it or we don't, but it won't be back to decisions on who's the partners, what are we going to do next. Is that correct?
Representative Wilson to the chair, that is correct with respect to the pipeline itself and the design and the engineering design and construction process. As you know, we have a series of other decisions that have to be made in terms of the RAK election, the terms. We have governance issues. There's lots of pieces and parts. Most of those are with the administration and the negotiation. There are also, again, decisions to be made as we go through the pre-feed process on a continual basis as we get more engineering, but that's as the sponsors group itself.
But AGDC will then be the ones in charge of the project from this point on if we pass this legislation.
You want to say something?
If I might, Representative Wilson, through the chair, I think the distinction is that there, yes, on the project, on all the project pieces, AGDC would be the ones having the discussion about funding along with the executive on moving into FEED, moving into final investment decision, those kind of things. The element that Commissioner Myers was referring to are the commercial agreements associated with fiscals, royalties, those kind of things will still be through the executive, and we would bring those contracts to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I, just for the committee here and trying to keep things rolling along, we've got other legislators. I have asked staff to scan the room briefly. You know, once in a while, if there's other legislators that have any questions, they can get them to the chair to be asked. But and again, just we had discussed earlier, this will be available to all legislators. We'll go through it tonight. they can write their questions. We'll make sure that they're all done tomorrow, too, to make sure everybody's got a chance. If there's something extremely pertinent, then we'll get to that. Representative Wilson, are you done?
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Good questions. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Just in kind of following up to what Representative Wilson asked, I am gratified to hear the administration's respect for the executive branch's role and the legislature's role in appropriating funds. I appreciate hearing that. And I actually will go back and listen to the tape to make sure I understand the reasons for not wanting to actually make that decision. But I will say that even though it might be a little be awkward, I think it's important to respect that decision tree and the separation of powers and say your responsibility, Commissioner, is to make that decision and then come to us and request the funding for that, and we evaluate that decision. But in general, we are in Juneau, this week, this month, to talk about the abandoning the process that saw TransCanada as Alaska's partner in the AKLNG. We've heard from the commission, deputy commissioner, some general points that the administration has had some disagreements with TransCanada. And I think it's important for me and others to understand how the process that was laid out in SB 138, which is currently the law of the land, how well it was pursued, how far progress was made, and before we decide to change it fundamentally. So my question then, can you characterize, can you give me a schedule of how often the administration's team met with TransCanada to work on the FT and the balancing agreements and the marketing, all those kinds of things? What was TransCanada's involvement with the administration so far this past 10 months?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, there's a distinction. TransCanada has been very involved in all the project aspects of the activities, since they are part of the project management team and all of their subcommittees. They are not a party to some of the commercial discussions because they are not involved in the upstream gas supply or the sovereign's decisions on fiscals. Okay. The firm transportation service agreement, there has been some discussions with this administration that actually started in December, and they continued off and on through June. And then as this administration became more aware of some of the difficulties with information and as some of the governance tensions began to develop, not with TransCanada, but recognizing that governance with a split ownership was going to be difficult in the project, we began to move towards a termination decision. So I can't tell you, I know how many exact meetings there were, but they were, I'd be surprised if they weren't weekly meetings.
Thank you. So can you characterize generally when the decision was made, Deputy Commissioner Rutherford, that you came to the point where the issues about information or whatever else it was that motivated you to move towards a termination decision, when did that happen? When was that tipping point?
I'm not sure. I'm sorry, Representative Sadler, through the chair. I'm not sure there was a specific date that I can recall. I think as we began to recognize that it was perhaps more in the state's interest, we began to look both at the economics of the decision, the information flow, some of the governance questions as we were beginning to negotiate governance. So it was this general recognition that we began to believe it was more in the state's interest to have the state hold its own equity instead of having an agent in the middle.
Could you bring it to a month even?
Maybe Representative Sadler through the chair, perhaps the Commissioner Myers might have a better recollection than I do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sadler, one of the things that was really important is, again, as the administration transitioned, we have new commissioners. We take a lot of education. Some of us are kind of slow learners at times. And it took time to really understand the economics of the project. Plus, the LNG market was changing on us. And one of the things we've looked at seriously with the help of Black & Veatch and others is how to protect the state's downside. because of the volatility we've seen in the gas market, the changes we've seen. We recognize now that models and predictions about oil price-linked LNG pricing are not as robust as we would like them to be. I don't think anyone was modeling less than $70 oil-linked pricing for LNG. So as you look at the Pacific Rim market and recognize there's huge volatility in the market, maximizing value for the state became really, really critical. And we looked at all the places where we could maximize value in terms of netting back a higher wellhead value, and this came up as a prime area where, as Deepa has shown you, there's significant value to the state on the upside. And again, you could argue more risk, but then when we really did the analysis, again, of the TransCanada structure, we felt we were taking additional risk by not buying them out and losing upside, which could really protect us, particularly if we see a lower price environment. We're that much more competitive for ourselves. So to me, as commissioner, that was, in the end, the major reason. Increased economic value to the state, lowering our actual risk of enduring low return price cycles. And so that was an evolving thing, again, coming in January as we worked through data, as we saw more data, that became more conclusive as important. The communications issues were, you know, they were there various times, and a lot of that depending on the timing of meeting of the MANCOM and other issues. But it was really the reason to come forward is a belief that we are better off economically on the project. We are more protected, particularly as we have learned in this new environment, this lower price oil and gas environment that we're in.
Right. But to follow up, Mr. Chairman, the oil price, as I recall, was dropping even before we took office this last year. So understand that all those are important factors, Commissioner. There has to have been some time when you made the pivot from we're going to make this work, TransCanada is a valuable partner, we're going to work this out, to where you decided, all those factors you considered, decided that you should have them pull out. That had to have been at some point. Can you even narrow it down to a month or so? Which of the past 10 months?
Yeah, Representative Sadler, it would be in this summer. And again, I think going back to looking at the market volatility and understanding that, we've had a lot of internal research since then. We've looked at competitive projects. We've looked, even though the oil prices have fallen, this idea of whether or not we will see future LNG prices linked to oil or not has seen a lot more information and knowledge base now. Whether the Henry Hub prices, the Cheniers of the world, as they come forward, we're learning a lot more about our commercial competition. That has been an evolving thing. I think that's occurred. And by the time the summer came around, you know, I think the whole industry was looking at, hey, are we in a longer-term systematic change or not? So to make the project to maximize competitiveness for us, given those values that we saw out there, it became increasingly more important. And I would say that probably June or July we had the data. We also had the model runs that you see, that again are reproducer with public data. We have with the confidential data from the project. So working through it, I said I would think it evolved. Again, as we worked through the negotiations, it just really, again, made sense to do it. From the, I think Representative Garris pointed out that we can't, it's hard to find a case where it's not in the state's interest in our modeling.
Okay. And the last timeline question. So if that is the case, and it was sometime midsummer, thank you, Mr. Chairman, if a certain decision tree is followed, the Deputy Commissioner said that he would resume work on an FTSA. How much more work is there to be done in the Foreign Transportation Services Agreement should this not go the way you guys are asking for it to go? Would we still meet the timeline of next December?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, we've asked ourselves that question, and we think we can get it done, probably finalized, completed within a couple of weeks.
Thank you. I just want to go back to one of the questions that Representative Sadler asked while it was on point. Commissioner, you talked about risk to the state and analyzing the separation between the state and TransCanada. The state's other partners are watching what's going on with the relationship between the state and TransCanada. How would you analyze, or how did you analyze their risk assessments with the state separating from TransCanada, or with the state staying with TransCanada as a partner with their expertise? How did you develop your analysis on that?
Representative Newman, through the chair, we certainly were looking at, through yourself, rather. We certainly had discussions with the LNG team that was developing it, many led by Exxon. We were aware of the challenges of, again, the secondees from TransCanada being very important to the project. We're also aware that the governance has not progressed as fast as we had hoped it would. So we wanted to know who the operators would be of the various components, whether, you know, again, TransCanada presumed is operative, but not necessarily until that's locked down in the governance of the pipeline. So given that, TransCanada's being able to second, was if they were going to second folks into the project, would allow for a smooth transition. And again, we do not know who's going to operate. Okay, and again, I don't want to talk about anything that's confidential within the project, but I don't think this is. I mean, we haven't announced a project operator for each of the components, right? It's not been announced. So I think it's, again, from a public sense, we're honestly working through to, you know, the governance pieces of this have to be finalized, and they have not been finalized. So again, that would be the biggest concern. You know, if TransCanada had been chosen to be the operator, that decision had been elected and made public, you might feel differently. But we're early enough in the project where there can be successful transition. There are a lot of quality people out there. TransCanada is a great company.
Let me ask the question a different way.
Okay.
Let me go and get the answer. When you did your analysis on separation from TransCanada, was there any discussion on the partners? I mean, we have other partners in this. Is their risk increase, decrease, stay the same? How would they look at the state separating from TransCanada? Would it increase their risk or would it decrease their risk?
Mr. Chairman, if I might answer that question, because I'm the actual one who've had those conversations. We did ask our partners in AKLNG, and they said they had no preference. It was up to the state. It was a state decision, and they have been very specific on that consistently.
Thank you. Representative Kosak.
Briefly, and just to say that the reason why we're here is that every version of Senate Bill 138 or House Bill 277 had envisioned a time where we get to decide this. So that's why we're here, and new administration had to figure out whether it was the best thing to do. But my question, because I'm still a little shocked at this, because originally I figured this was, you know, kind of a divorce. We're divorcing TransCanada. It's a little messy. I mean, there's joint property, obviously millions at stake. But to hear that TransCanada might, and I guess they're going to be here later to talk a little bit more about it, sounds instead more of a dissolution instead of a divorce. I guess that's the way we were just dating. But now, I mean, that now this makes me a little bit uncomfortable. I guess I don't know if it makes any other members comfortable or the administration uncomfortable about having a partner that isn't 100% like gung ho about this relationship.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I think that it's better for TransCanada to speak for themselves, obviously. But yes, they have been very clear that they we should feel free to state that they too want to end the relationship.
I've got discomfort now to hear through the chair to hear that. And I guess the second point is then what would happen then. I mean, is there any fear from the administration that TransCanada just pulls out of the participating agreement at a certain date?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, that has always been a possibility, and it would remain a possibility if they're not terminated at this juncture. They could have done that before this point. They could do this after this point. So I think that is a fair concern.
And then through the chair, I guess. So, I mean, we would be several years down the road and several hundred million dollars into it, and then knowing that our partner was willing for dissolution at that point, I guess it sounds like a real costly gamble.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, yes, and I think the financial group spoke to that exact issue yesterday, and in their in terms of state risks and in terms of when the funding increases and when we're called upon to pay that off, that is always a you know, as we go forward. That is, if we don't buy them out now, it is a risk moving forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This might be backtracking a little bit, but okay, we've got the end of December to terminate, or it goes on for another 4 years before we have another out. Where have we deviated from Senate Bill 138? You know, all of the time frames that were set out in 138, where have we deviated from that blueprint that went through? And then at the same time, to follow up with that, what deadlines that were proposed in the heads of agreement have not been met? And because of those not being done, this December 31st deadline, has there been any negotiations with TransCanada about making it maybe July 31st so we can get those other things in line, and maybe that would help make TransCanada feel that we are cooperating more with them? That's a lot of question there, but
Representative Thompson, through the chair, I cannot recall off the top of my head if there were any deadlines within the MOU or the heads of agreement, that we have missed. We actually are looking at that right now because of a question we received from the Senate earlier today. So we'll hopefully have you some information later in the day or tomorrow morning. However, I do not believe we've actually missed any deadlines, but we're looking. And the one thing, though, that I will say, it was always hoped that the commercial agreements would be in place prior to entering into a firm transportation service agreement. So since those are not yet available, it does make it more difficult to do so. Yes.
Representative Thompson, yes, but on that point, can you give us in writing where we're at in those negotiations?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we will.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you. Okay, so without TransCanada's involvement, who's responsible for engineering and commercial work on future pipeline expansion to accommodate gas not owned by the producers, such as maybe gas in the Nenana Basin? Who's going to be responsible for doing that engineering and work?
Representative Thompson, through the chair, the project will be. The project is the party who will be operating the pipeline. There has been no decisions made yet as to whether it will be governed as an integrated project or whether there will be operators for each segment, the GTP, the pipeline, and the liquefaction. That is part of the governance decision. But one of the things that is happening are discussions on the commercial level about under what terms the project will have to address third-party access and expansion demands.
Follow up on that along those same lines. Who would own the infrastructure to monetize the gas of a partner that withdrew? And would the financial burden for doing this fall upon the state of Alaska, or would this be different if TransCanada was to stay involved?
Co-Chair Thompson, if one of the producer parties withdrew from the project, then it would fall upon the remaining AKLNG parties, and so, you know, the other two producers and the state to evaluate their options at that time to move the project forward. You know, obviously it would have the financial side of it, but you also need to, you know, if one of the three producers effectively control the gas on the slope, and so we would have to figure out how the continuing project would have access to their gas. That would be one issue. And, you know, and then whether the three remaining parties would want to pick up the, you know, the exiting parties part of the project or bring in another partner would be a decision that would need to be taken then.
Representative Thompson, if I might, I'd like to add something to that. I think you bring up a really good point, and there's. But I want to first answer one of your questions that you articulated. It makes no difference whether TransCanada is our agent as a our agent on the pipeline or the GTP, because you know we the project itself will still be dealing with the a withdrawal of a partner. However, also, it is one of the reasons why Governor Walker feels so strongly about having commitments from the producers on should they withdraw, should they not wish to move the project forward for any reason, that, in fact, there will be some provision for the making the gas available. And the reason that's so critical is because volumes make a huge difference on the cost of the supply and the economics of the overall AKLNG project.
Wouldn't it make a lot of sense to TransCanada to maybe take on and buy that gas from the withdrawing party and let them do the profit side? Because it might be a very expensive undertaking for the state of Alaska to do it, and maybe the other partners aren't really interested.
Representative Thompson, through the chair, they're not in that business. They are not a gas seller or marketer. They're a pipeline operator. It's a significantly different component of the business. Mm-hmm. If I could answer one of your other questions, one of the important about the Nanana Basin question or expansion of other gas, that is one of the reasons the state wants a 48-inch pipeline or has recommended it. It's that much easier to expand on a base load, much less in compressor stations, much more available capacity within that pipe to take additional gas with very little difference in the compression. So for things like the Nanana Basin can be handled a number of different ways, but the state wanted to ensure there was capacity for those issues. Clearly, the issue of putting an intake point on the Nanana Basin would be something you would look at along with the offtake points for gas for, say, Fairbanks and other locations. But AGDC has the offtake responsibility to locate and manage the offtake piece. But in addition, the state the commercial side that the AKLNG on the state's negotiating is assure that the expansion terms in the project are favorable to allow other parties to bring gas in. That because of the under the current FERC regulation for an LNG project of this type, there's not an assured easy expansion route. So it's, commercially, we are negotiating. It's one of the major negotiation issues to assure there's language in there that supports that. Again, if you're a producer that has gas in two large fields, you're not exploring in the Nanana Basin, any gas that comes in the system is competitive to you. So you're not going to be in a position to want to do that. The state's different. The state has a desire to see additional gas, whether it be state, whether it be Doyon, et cetera, to come into the system. We know we all benefit from that. So that's one of the points where the state has been negotiating very hard to assure that the commercial terms allow for that gas to come into the system in a way that's favorable to our explorers and developers elsewhere.
Okay.
Representative Thompson.
Yes, just one final then. I think you said that the Attorney General is looking at the statutory authority for AGDC to take on the lead for gas to gas treatment plant and the pipe. Can you give us a time frame when the Attorney General will be getting us a decision on that? Because I think that's huge. We've got to make sure who's going to be taking over for TransCanada if we approve this.
Representative Thompson, I believe that is being hoped to have that completed by tomorrow. But based upon some language I just looked at, I would say that the authority already does reside in AGDC, but we'll be getting a firm legal opinion by tomorrow, I believe.
Thank you.
Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We spoke about the timeline to pay TransCanada, 30 days, 120 days. But, you know, it brought to mind when we talked about the billing from TransCanada and, more importantly, the auditing on our part. So are we up to speed? I mean, will it take longer than 120 days for us to go through all their bills to audit? So I could see the scenario that we might agree to buy TransCanada out, we're going to save money and all kinds of great things, but then we go over 120 days because we're really behind schedule in just auditing and so on and so forth. So my question is, are we current with our auditing and or would we have to backtrack and spend months working that out?
Representative Gattis, through the chair, let me make sure that the answer we give you is accurate. I want to check with revenue and do it in writing. But I think there are provisions to accommodate any challenges to their billings that doesn't negatively affect the state's payment responsibilities.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm going to jump in for a few questions here. I'll go back to the presentation, go to slide 6. This talks about the off-ramps or termination clauses that are in 138 for TransCanada. What options does the state of Alaska have? And we didn't hear anything about that. What options does the state of Alaska have as far as off-ramps and costs and liabilities to the state?
Mr. Chair, so the state as well as TransCanada have the option of terminating the PA. So the December 2015 clean off ramp is one that both parties have, and we will continue to have both parties, the state as well as TransCanada, have those off ramps going through December 2018.
So does the state have the same options and off ramps for termination as TC?
Yes, and you'll see when you get the opportunity to review the precedent agreement, there are slightly different conditions that trigger termination, but both parties have the ability to terminate the PA.
So I'm assuming that the administration has a plan B. What if House Bill 3001 doesn't pass? What is your plan B? And with that, what is your plan B?
Mr. Chair, if TransCanada's termination is not possible, then the state will negotiate and execute the firm transportation services agreement.
What involves that? What is that? How does that happen? Tell us how that happens.
We would negotiate the terms of a long-term, 20 to 25 years transportation services agreement with TransCanada. We would agree on what tariffs we would pay them. There would be, obligations on both sides, their side to provide the service to us, our side to, make the payments needed against those services during the project's operation.
Let's carry that through. So if this legislation didn't pass, state didn't spend another $160 million, pipeline, the TransCanada and the other producers continue on, they would build a pipeline. Risk to the state would be very minimal. Our profits at the end of the year wouldn't be as much. I'm trying to figure this out.
Sure, and maybe it will help if we went here. Slide 19, Mr. Chair. This essentially shows what, from a cash flow perspective, where the state would be. And the blue line here is the path where the state terminates TransCanada and takes its own ownership in the GTPN pipeline. And the green path would be where the state does not terminate TransCanada, enters into an FTSA with TransCanada, and effectively, we would achieve lower revenues to the state to the tune of, up to $400 million less per year.
So if we have a chart like this, you developed this. I don't know what baseline methodology and the numbers that you used on that. Could you get something that explains that?
Yes, we can do that. And actually, Representative Guerra, through the chair, if you'll indulge me, can I clarify on the question you asked me earlier on whether the $400 million per year would be a net benefit of all of the costs and investment that the state would make in the project? I want to point out that the assumption behind the $400 million or the $360 million is that the state would finance, its $7 billion with 30% equity and 70% debt. And so there would be a $2 billion upfront, equity investment in the project. And the net effect of that is what is shown in that little table here, where the state still comes out at, $5 billion more, even with that upfront investment.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just also note that we have made Black and Veatch available to work with Analytica, who's under contract with the legislature, to ensure that they have complete access to our modeling and the premises that went into that modeling, so that you will have direct communication with your own contractor who can tell you where they agree or disagree with the premises in that modeling.
Mm-hmm. Plan on doing that.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add one other comment. We have five parties, all of which can terminate this project at any point in time. We can't be sure. I mean, with four parties, there's one less party that has the option to terminate. So I do not know, you know, again, not forecasting any parties terminating, but you simply build more project assurity on the state side with four parties rather than five with that option to terminate.
So let's go back on page six. So TransCanada has the opportunity right now to be able to pull out of this agreement. State settles up with the work that they've done as the lead, taking the lead through the association and partnership that we have with all of us to get to this point. They can pull out, reduce their risks, boom, right out of it. You earlier stated that the state has the same opportunities as TransCanada. So does the state have the opportunity in 5 years? If we pulled out now, could we have the opportunity to come back and join in 5 years? TC can do that.
Mr. Chairman, if we fail to sign the WPMB, then the project stops.
But Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure we understood your question. We have the right to terminate, I believe, up until the final investment decision, just as does TransCanada, even after we have the firm transportation service agreement in place. But then they, after December 31st, 2015, they have this back out right that Deepa Potaval mentioned earlier, where if at any time the AKLNG project were to terminate, they, TransCanada, have, and the state started pursuing an alternative project that was similar in nature, they would have a back-in right back into that project for a period of 5 years.
Does the state have that same right? Earlier you said the state has the same rights as TC.
Mr. Chairman, I must have misspoke. We cannot force TransCanada to stay with us, no.
In the state, does the state have the same ability to buy back in or do the same rights that TransCanada has is to reenter back into the project, into the pipeline?
Mr. Chairman, TransCanada has no separate prerogatives associated with AKLNG from the state of Alaska. They are simply our agent on two segments of the project.
We'll delve into that one a little further. I'll ask you privately where I'm trying to go on answer. Either you don't want to answer it or I'm not asking it right. I'm on page 26 here on my notes. I look at this, and this goes back into exercising the right under termination option. And you have in here in the second paragraph, the back-in rights states that within 5 years that the state's participation that TransCanada can come back in. Does the state have that same right?
So this, Mr. Chair, so the back-in right relates specifically to the relationship between the state and TransCanada and the ability that we've given them to take our 25% in the GTP and pipeline. If the state chooses to terminate that relationship with TransCanada and TransCanada is no longer part of AKLNG, you know, if we make that decision after December 2015, they have the right, if we pursue a substantially similar project, to come back into the project. You're asking if that works the other way around, where...
Yes.
Where if the state terminates the relationship with TransCanada, whether the state can come back into the project or bring TransCanada in. I think the state can bring TransCanada in, but we will already be in the project. And if the state is not in the AKLNG project, the project itself, as Commissioner Myers mentioned, will likely be terminated.
Mr. Chairman, let me ask you a question. I think maybe what you're asking is if TransCanada independently began to pursue an alternative project in the state of Alaska with different players or the same players, if we had terminated AKLNG, do we have those same back-end rights? I do not believe we do.
Here's what I'm trying to emphasize with all of this. Through this exercise on House Bill 138 or Senate Bill 138, the enabling language that continued the ask AKLNG project. Nothing we do is perfect. Nothing we do is perfect. There's things that you've come along through this process and went, wow, this is maybe not the best option for the state, but it's what 138 says. I'm sure that that's happened. That was my emphasis of why do we have a plan B? If things don't work out, what options would we want to put in a plan B piece of legislation? What if the governor wanted to introduce a separate bill that protected the state's rights more? Is there opportunities like that? What have you talked about if this doesn't happen? What's the plan B?
Mr. Chairman, if TransCanada chose to terminate with us, the Plan B is embedded in SB 138. Plan B is for AGDC to pick up that role and for us to move forward on the project. And that is exactly what we are suggesting we do.
There's still a question whether AGDC has statutory authority to even do that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and we will get you that answer.
So let's assume that the answer is not what you want, that AGDC does not have the statutory authority to pull back in here. What is Plan B?
Mr. Chairman, I believe Plan B is to pursue the FTSA with TransCanada.
Representative Agin.
Back, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, what I haven't heard in this discussion and the discussion yesterday with the consultants, the analysts, is an analysis of whether TransCanada brings more than just its financial advantages to this deal. We've seen the net present value slides. We've seen the net cash flow advantages and so forth. But that all seems to assume that the success of the AKLNG project is as likely with TransCanada's involvement as without. So my question is, can you help me understand, can you show us evidence of your analysis that shows that the chances of getting to a final investment decision, setting aside the financial issues, are stronger without TransCanada involved than with? And whoever wants to take that. Actually, the commissioner, I want to hear him.
President Sadler, first of all, you need to hear from TransCanada. The bottom line as to what they desire and what their and how they would phrase it. They're a world-class pipeline company. We have a lot of respect for them. There are other world-class pipeline companies out there, too. Again, so certainly they bring value to the project, there's no doubt. Whether they would be better than Enbridge or one of the producers' pipeline companies, again, that's sort of that's going to be a value judgment. But ultimately, remember, the operator of the system is not determined. We do not know who's going to actually operate the pipeline, because that part is a part of the governance decision yet to be made. So again, it's somewhat subjective in terms of their value. Certainly, there's valuable employees seconded to the project, and that is one of the issues that is being worked by the project to maintain continuity through that piece. And so basically, you know, there's two pieces. One is who's actually going to design and build the pipeline, and then who is going to be the state's agent for the pipeline. Mm-hmm. What we're proposing here is that the state agent for the pipeline, not the operator of the pipeline, would be AGDC. So again, it's a very different role than actually operating the pipeline itself. So that's how that, you know, so fundamentally when you look at it, the project has to define those operators and look at it after it completes its engineering design work, its front engineering design work. So that's the best answer I can give you.
Mr. Chairman, if I just might add, Representative Sadler, not only has the operator not been yet determined,
the contract developer, the contractor who builds the pipeline, has not yet been determined. Just it is quite possible that even if TransCanada stayed in the project as the state agent on the equity pieces, that the project would not choose TransCanada to be the contractor to construct that element of the project. That is a project decision as well. Thank you.
And could I follow up on that? Understanding you've made some important distinctions about who will actually design, build, and operate, we're still in the middle of pre-FEED and FEED. It's a process. It's a structure. My goal, my desire, is to get us to FID. And if TransCanada is an advantage in building credibility, again, the financing part aside, if they help bring us integrity and credibility with our partners from world markets, I see TransCanada continuing to bring advantage to that. If you've got evidence, you can show me your analysis showing that's not the case. I would sure appreciate seeing that. But thank you.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I would just maybe offer one data point, and Deputy Commissioner Rutherford mentioned that. Obviously, the AKLNG partners are deeply vested in making, in maximizing the likelihood of success of this project. And as you've heard from Deputy Commissioner Rutherford before, they have essentially said, it's the state's decision. They're really neutral on whether or not TransCanada stays. And that tells me that they believe that the technical, capabilities that are needed to continue the project forward, they're comfortable that those needs can be met between the remaining project partners as well as the contractors that will be brought on.
Thank you. I'm going to jump into this one more time. Briefly, earlier, Deputy Commissioner Rutherford, you mentioned on statutory authority in 138 whether AGDC, Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, has the ability to move forward and be this state's representative on the pipeline portion and the gas treatment plant. You said that that's in question. You said that that's in question because I referenced back to 138. And my understanding of what I read was that the Alaska legislature under 138 allowed Alaska Gasline Development Corporation to represent us and to be our agent in the gas liquefaction facility. The end of the line. It did not say a representative in there. So now TransCanada also has the ability to say, you know what, we want out. And you stated that TransCanada wants out. So now we've got TransCanada wants out. We've got questions of whether the AGDC has the statutory authority to move forward as the state's representative on the pipeline and the gas treatment plant. If that comes back, that they don't have the authority, because in 138, for whatever reason, that wasn't thought of. What happens? Where's Plan B? Does this all just blow up? If they can't represent us as the state, and TransCanada wants out, which you've said they want out, what's Plan B? Does the governor bring in another piece of legislation and a special session that asks the legislature to give them authority to be our representatives in that?
Mr. Chairman, yes, let me clarify a couple things. I don't think that the AGDC there is a question on their authority. It has been asked of the administration, so Department of Law is looking at it and answering that question. I don't think the administration has questioned that. Secondly, I don't think I said that TransCanada said they want out, and they certainly will be able to speak for themselves, but they have said they support the appropriation. So I think that our presumption is that if, in fact, for some reason you didn't fund the appropriation, we would continue with TransCanada. I have not heard them say categorically that they would leave us, but that's a question you need to put to them as well, because that is not exactly what they have said to me.
Commissioner, it's my understanding that TransCanada has represented the fact that they would like to get out of this deal now. And I believe that I spoke to you earlier, and you told me TransCanada would like out.
Mr. Chairman, they would like us to fund the termination. I actually have no certainty that if it wasn't funded, whether they would choose to leave us. They have never said those words to either Mark Myers, Commissioner Myers, or myself.
Okay, thank you. We'll work on that one later, I guess, when we get TransCanada here. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are some questions about when you arrived at this decision that it's in the state's best interest to get TransCanada out of the project. Ms. Potavel, this is for you, and then anybody else who wants to chime in. But and tell me if I mischaracterize anything, because that's important. But you've shared your conclusions that if this pipeline moves ahead, we make more money without TransCanada. If this pipeline project fails, the state saves money. We lose less money by not having TransCanada. That was your charge to analyze that for this administration, but that was also your charge to analyze under the Parnell administration as well. Is that not true?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, yes, that is true.
And Ms. Potavel, your conclusion that the state is best off without TransCanada, you wouldn't have altered that conclusion if you were still working for the Parnell administration, would you?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, as I mentioned before, the fundamental economic trade-off has always been known to us. You know, the analysis that's in the current report is very similar to the analysis that we had, you know, before you for SB 138. You know, that trade-off, do we want to put more money now, get more money later, or not, is the exact same question as it was before. And my answer is still the same.
Thank you. Through the chair.
Go ahead, Representative.
And I would be uncomfortable with this whole project if we were to just go ahead and build a pipeline, $71 billion or $7.1 billion to the state, and then not be able to find a customer. That would be crazy. But the way it works in the pipeline world, and Ms. Potavel, if you could tell me if I'm wrong and explain, please. But the way it works in the pipeline world is no pipeline owner builds a pipeline and the associated infrastructure spends all that money until they have somebody who's going to sell all the gas that they need and somebody who's going to buy all the gas that they need, and that the sales price is high enough that the pipeline company and the other infrastructure companies will make money. And is that correct? And that we're not the 94% of the costs involved in this project, nobody's going to spend that money until they know they have a high enough price to make money, a seller of enough gas, and a buyer of the gas. You don't go ahead with those construction costs. Is that correct?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, yes. The short answer is yes. And I would, in fact, say those factors are maybe compounded in an LNG project, even more than, you know, a pipeline project. LNG projects are inherently very capital intensive, and they pay back that capital through long-term cash flows. That's the business model that works. And as I mentioned before, as you go through the different project phases here, you go through the pre-FEED, you go through FEED, and by then you have sketched out all of the important uncertainties related to the project. And just the magnitude of money that we're talking about here, $45 to $65 billion, at that point, the project partners have sketched out the engineering details to the minutest detail they can get to. They have worked the financial community to reduce their cost of capital going into this, and so they have their financing done. And most importantly, they have acquired buyers for the LNG that are willing to commit over the long term to take the volumes that will be produced from Alaska and, you know, pay a price that is going to be indexed most likely to oil. So all of those pieces will have to come together before you take that final investment decision, before any of the parties will take final investment decision. It will be board approved, and, you know, that's when the puzzle comes together. And it's that chain of commitments, firm, long-term commitments, on the back of which the funding is available for this project, and you actually kick off your EPC contractors and start building it. So, yes, it won't be speculative in the least. That's just not how it can work.
Thank you. And through the chair. Thank you. There was a question, and I think I probably misheard it, or maybe it wasn't. We all sort of stumble through our words sometimes, so I won't presume to know if it was mistaken or not. But there was a question that sort of sounded like what we're doing now, deciding to get TransCanada out of the project. At least that's what you're recommending. And then the decision about whether to build a 48-inch pipe or a 42-inch pipe, those were clearly envisioned when SB 138 was passed. And I remember the recommendations from Mr. Pawlowski that they were going to try and see if they could make a 48-inch pipe feasible, because that was in our best interest if the gas was there. And they may very well want to get TransCanada out of the project. They were going to analyze it over the next year as they hired you. So those were consistent with SB 138. Just in case I misheard the question, there's nothing that we're deciding in this bill that violates or departs from the fundamentals of SB 138. This is all consistent with SB 138, isn't it? These are the exact questions that we were supposed to come and decide before December 15th of this year, correct?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, yes, your characterization is absolutely correct. The president agreement was designed to have these off-ramps, and as I mentioned, it was the legislature that said, when we get to that point in time, and if the state chooses to terminate TransCanada, we want the ability to do that clean. We don't want any back-in rights. The state needs the right to get to that juncture in time and decide if it wants to keep TransCanada in or not. So it was very much part of the plan that we would reach this decision point. And you're also right that, you know, starting from the Parnell administration, the state has been consistent in expressing its preference for a 48-inch pipeline. That is not a new position either. You know, and I was part of some of those discussions, and I know that, you know, the state has been very consistent about that preference as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On the point of, in 138, there was a considerable amount of discussion on legal counsel for the state, representation of the state. At the time, it was decided that the Attorney General's office would be act as legal counsel of the state on this. Commissioner Myers, you've worked in a lot of different options like this. I suspect probably legal counsel might have given different options. For all, have you come into any specific conclusions or issues where there was a real question on legal interpretations on 138, where maybe a independent legal counsel might have come up with different conclusions? Not that attorneys have different opinions.
Mr. Chairman, I've really been pleased with the legal support we've gotten out of the Department of Law in terms of the issues, also the Greenberg Trolley, and now our Milbanks attorneys that are working for us. It's a significant amount of money, but there is really a great discussion because, you know, put two of your lawyers in the room and they'll give you a different opinion. Put three and they'll give you three different opinions. And so meeting of the minds to get a good legal interpretation from a lot of experienced attorneys is a really valuable thing. I personally, as commissioner, very much value that discussion and that openness. I have not seen it. I mean, I think 138, the legal components of 138 are pretty well spelled out. The timing of getting all the commercial pieces together in the right order is one of the challenges with all the parties, because again, this is a very complex, it's a huge project, it's complex. At any given time, the company's economics are different. They have competing interests themselves. So bringing the alignment and the arm wrestling of the commercial negotiations has been the biggest challenge. It's just it takes a long time for this many parties with this many different views. Having worked in the upstream, having been, again, a decade in the industry working in the upstream, having been in the early stages of development of Kuparuk Field, being the developed geologist responsible for a big part of it, I've seen the arm wrestling of the companies over really small issues in terms of internal equity. And so it's not uncommon for companies to take a long time to make these complex commercial arrangements, particularly when their equities aren't equal between the two fields. So we're seeing a lot of that play out. It's a tough negotiation. I don't think in the bill they contemplated just the time frame. So the biggest thing I've seen isn't differing legal opinions, or it's really bringing commercial alignment among parties in a challenging economic time, and then the resources it takes to do that. We need a very robust, that's why you see a significant budget request for Department of Law in there. But I will say, I actually feel we're getting really good legal advice, but we need Department of Law and the consultants to do it.
Thank you. So we're, yeah, Representative Sadler, we'll try and wrap up here by 6.
Thank you. I can speak fast, I know.
Time to shoot at.
In reference to what...
7 or so.
In reference to what Representative Guerra just said, I think, yes, it is true that the decisions being asked of us were envisioned in SB 138, but the critical information that was to have been available to us and the work that should have been done before this decision point have not been given to us. The SB 138 process envisioned that we, the legislature, would gather in special session this fall to have before us a completed FTSA, royalty modification contracts, gas balancing, marketing contracts, the PILT decision. Those bits of information are essential to give us the ability to make an informed decision about buying out TransCanada or not. So, again, the decision to terminate lies squarely with the gentleman on that side of the witness table, and I really still don't understand the reluctance to do that so that the process can proceed in the proper sequence. And no question, just an observation. I'll wrap it up. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. And I think this is this is our first delve into this, what I, again, consider the real meat and potatoes of the discussion. It's an important discussion here. That's why we're doing what we're doing. Representative Wilson?
I just have one question. So in the statute, it does not determine whether or not 42 or 48 in that legislation, it left it open to how big the pipe should be?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. Yeah, the statute does not specify what the pipeline size would be. That is a decision that will be taken by the AKLNG project team. The statute does include a requirement that a larger diameter pipeline be studied and a report be presented to the legislature.
Okay, because I thought it did, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Any more questions? Then? Okay, thank you. So just wrapping up then, we've got the presentation that we had today. Fairly extensive presentation. We again are asking all members of the legislature, if they've got questions, to send them through the chairs. Representative Thompson or myself can deal with this and get them to us. So we've got them to you. The sooner the better, so we can get them to the department. You know, I don't like to play gotcha. The sooner you have the questions, the better discussions that we can have, because the better information that we all have. So it just works. It's a good process. Other than that, I guess we'll start out here tomorrow, and then we'll continue on with presentations. Deputy Commissioner Rutherford, did you want to go through the participation decision primer at all tomorrow?
Mr. Chairman, no. I think we feel it's just simply a narrative describing what was in the Black and Veatch report, and so and this report as well, or our slide pack. So it's not necessary, but if you want any questions answered as a result of their reviewing it, we'd be glad to answer them.
Also, could you get us somewhat of an executive summary, a review back, a refresher on 138? We continue to refer back to that. If you could get us some written information on the bullet points or the higher priorities that you're working on and that and why, is basically a little bit of an executive summary to help us catch up on where we're at.
We'll work on that, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. Oh, yeah, okay, so Co-Chair Thompson reminded me that tomorrow we will be here at 1:30. So I guess we've got our homework for tonight. Thank you all for your attention, for the members of the public and all who are here. Thank you. We'll adjourn.